Okay, tonight we're in Exodus chapter 21. Last time we were in Exodus 20, and we spent a lot of time talking about the Ten Commandments. As a reminder, Exodus 20, 21, 22, 23, commonly known as the Book of the Covenant. So this is the covenantal document which God provides as he enters in relationship with the nation Israel, which he has created out of slavery in Egypt. Okay, and we talked last time about grace and then commands and obedience and then grace. And so we saw that last time in Exodus 20, verse 1. Then God spoke all these words, saying, verse 2, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's the grace and the mercy. And then that's followed by the Decalogue, the 10 words, the 10 commandments. And so tonight, as we continue our way through the Book of the Covenant, we're going to talk about Exodus chapter 21 and see how God now expounds on the 10 commandments. Okay. In addition to that, we will see how he provides, and I mentioned this last time, one of the main purposes of the law of God is to set his people apart from the nations. Okay? So, he's anticipating that the Israelites are going to go into Canaan. And so some of his laws throughout Exodus and Leviticus are about the holiness of his people compared to the people who were dwelling in Canaan. Some of the laws that we read in Exodus, specifically what we'll discuss tonight, provide for the holiness of his people, the separateness of his people, the contrasting of his people with the Egyptians. That's what I want you to see as an overarching theme tonight. There will be clear contrast with the Egyptians. Because tonight we're going to talk relatively substantially about slavery. Okay? Now, for reference, in March of 2015, on March 29th, 2015, okay, fully 4.5 years ago, I preached a sermon called Slaves and Masters, okay, from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, right, where when Paul gives his instructions to the masters and to the slaves, I spent a long time talking about slavery, what slavery meant in the first century, why the Bible doesn't just come out and abolish slavery, right? And so there's a lot of background information in that particular message. It's called Slaves and Masters from March 29th, 2015. I commend that to you. There's a lot of background information there, okay? I'll talk a little bit about that tonight just to set the context. All right, but there's a lot more to be said about the slavery that we read about in Exodus 21. Okay, so let's just pick up and see what we can see. Exodus 21, beginning in verse 1. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them, that is, the Israelites, right? He's speaking to Moses now, right? Because previously the Israelites had begged Moses to talk to God, right? Don't let him talk to us. You go talk to him, right? So God's speaking to Moses. These are the ordinances which you are to set before them, the Israelites. Verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. But on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. And if he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Verse 7. And if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. And if he will not do these three things for her, then he shall go out for nothing. Then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. All right, here we go. As I mentioned in my sermon back in March 2015, I will say again, right? Why would a Hebrew buy another Hebrew? Okay? One possibility, right, is that one Israelite, one Hebrew, experiences severe financial difficulty. Okay? So, for example, in our modern context, we have bankruptcy laws, bankruptcy court, and bankruptcy protections for individuals or for corporations. At this time, 1500 BC or so, said protections did not exist. And so if a man, either alone or his family, found himself, for whatever reason, in financial hardship or even ruin, he would be, for the purpose of survival of himself alone or his family, he would be willing to enter into what we would call indentured servitude to his neighbor. It becomes then a source of income, a source of protection, a source of sustenance. Okay? And there are other things that we might imagine. Okay? But that's the easiest one for us to understand. There are certain reasons why a man would, quote, sell himself to a neighbor. All right? And again, he could go in alone, if he's a single man, or he could go in his entire family. What I want you to see as we go through verses 2 through 11 is that the ordinances, verse 1, which God sets up to regulate slavery are in clear contrast to how the Israelites were treated in Egypt. Do you see that? So the first thing we should see, verse 2, if you buy, and by the way, another reason, which we'll get to next time we get together to talk about Exodus, so turn very quickly over to Exodus 22, verse 3. Let's begin in verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Verse 2, if the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. Verse 3, but if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So sometimes a man being sold into slavery, right? So this is like Exhibit B. Exhibit A was bankruptcy, financial ruin. Exhibit B is, if a guy's a thief, and he literally owns nothing, the only thing that he can give to make restitution for his stealing is himself. And the law says, he shall be sold as a slave to make up for the stolen goods. Okay? So there's exhibit D. Now, this thief, this slave, if you buy a Hebrew slave, verse 2, Exodus 21, he shall serve for 6 years. But on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. So, in contrast to what the Egyptians were doing to the Israelites, i.e., holding them under bondage interminably, generation after generation, we saw for the better part of 2 centuries back in that study, God is regulating indentured servitude in Israel in a merciful way. That is, the Hebrew slave comes in, but he can only come in for a maximum 6 years. And then he's to go out as a free man. And the understanding there, of course, is that over the course of that 6 years, it's a sufficient amount of time, right? And the master will pay and compensate the slave sufficiently such that after 6 years, that slave is, quote unquote, back on his own feet. Either as a single man or as a family unit. Okay? He shall go out as a free man without payment. That is, after 6 years, he can go free and doesn't have to pay the master anything to buy his freedom. All right? If he comes alone, verse 3, he shall go out alone. If he's the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. So if he brings his family, the assumption is that he, his wife, his of-age children are all contributing to the master's benefit and are being compensated so that when they leave as free people, they have been cared for. All right? So instead of us seeing the word slave as 21st century post-Civil War Americans and seeing, right, having this sort of stamp saying, oh, all slavery is wrong, God is doing something wrong, he's unrighteous, right? We have to see this in its context and see it actually as mercy. And definitely in contrast to the way the Egyptians were dealing with the Israelites. Okay? Verse 4. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God, then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Now, what's going on here? In one sense, we see, and I hope I've made the case, that this indentured servitude is really merciful in the life of Israel for men and families who have found themselves in some sort of ruin. Okay? This stipulation is for the benefit of the master. Because, let's think about this, okay? So, the master brings in a single man. Of course, perhaps he has a female servant. Or even a daughter. Okay? Because it says, if his master gives him a wife, it's not. There's no stipulation either way. Okay, but let's assume it's a girl who's also in a situation where she's working for the master. The man comes in alone, and the man and the woman decide what are they going to do? They're going to get married. Why? So they can both leave after 6 years. This is protecting the master against what we would call marriages of convenience. Okay? Protecting the financial interests of the master. All right? And let's face it, okay? Jacob waited 7 years for Rachel. This guy, let's say he really loves this woman. Okay? He could wait. He could be patient. He could leave alone and then redeem the woman. Okay? At that point, the master is compensating. Okay? And so this is protection for the financial interests of the master. And so what happens in this case? If the master gives the woman to the man then has the choice. Right? And the assumption here is verse 5, not verse 4. The assumption is not that the man's going to leave alone. That's the protection of the master. The assumption is that verse 5, he knows the stipulation. He knows that if he marries this woman and they bear children together, he knows that he has now consigned himself to lifelong servitude. Okay? Now, what is the all through the ear? The all through the ear is a public statement, a public declaration on behalf of the servant saying, I have chosen this way of life. I am willingly staying. I knew when I took this woman as my wife and she bore me children, I knew what I was in for. And this sign in my, this hole in my ear tells everyone around that I am not being held against my will for the rest of my life by this man. I chose this life. That's what the clear physical public sign is for. Now, again, that's in direct contrast to the way the Egyptians dealt with the Israelites. Do you see that? The Israelites had no choice. They were being held in subjugation, in bondage, with no opportunity for freedom. They were being literally held against their will. This man who takes a hole in his ear is publicly making a declaration, not that I'm being held against my will, but I willingly made this choice to stay because I knew what the rules were going in. Okay? Very important distinction. And mercy. You're giving a man the choice to stay. In verse 6, it says, then his master shall bring him to God. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, it says a tribunal of God. So this is most likely some judges. Okay? So you go before the elders, the judges, you probably have that in your translation, right? And these judges, they hear the testimony, and before the elders or before the judges, this man consigns himself to permanent indentured servitude. And then they are the ones who put that sign in his ear as an act of authority as judges over top of the nation. It's a public, literally, trial or witness or testimony. Okay? That's what's going on in that text. So, the interests of the servant are protected. The interests of the servant's spouse are protected. And the interests of the master are protected. Verse 7. And if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. Okay, so there's, again, we read this and we're like, this isn't right. I'm telling you, it is right. All right? Now, I will say, right, for example, John Calvin would say that this is not ideal. It's not ideal that a man should sell his daughter into slavery. Now, why would a man do this? He would do it, again, maybe because of poverty. Maybe mom is dead, dad's about ready to die, daughter is not married yet. So he may do this as an act of care. Right? Sell his daughter as a servant, maybe even a wife, to a man to guarantee that his daughter will be cared for. Okay? Not the ideal situation, but Calvin would argue that this is a realistic situation which God chooses to regulate mercifully. Okay? He chooses to regulate this not ideal sort of, this is how we live in a fallen world, God knows that. God knows that some man is going to sell his daughter into servanthood or slavery, right? Either for righteous motives or unrighteous motives. And so God chooses to regulate it mercifully. How does he do that? Okay? First of all, he says, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. Why not? Well, what are you going to do? Just throw her out? Where's she going to go? Especially if the situation is that her parents are dead after 6 years. What are you going to just kick her out? No, God says no. That's not how it works. Okay? So that's the first thing. The second thing, 8, if she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. That is, if he's miserable and she's miserable, then a kinsman redeemer, maybe you're familiar with that term from the scriptures, can come and can purchase her out of that terrible situation. Maybe an aunt, maybe an uncle. So she can be redeemed out of that situation. Not only that, okay? He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. So, not only does the master have to let her be redeemed, but there's a guarantee here that she won't be redeemed to the Gentiles. To someone who is going to treat her poorly, like the Egyptians treated the Israelites. No, she must be redeemed by someone in her own nation, most likely her own tribe, most likely her own clan, most likely her own family, so that she will be cared for in a way that's regulated by the law. This law that God has given to them. Bless you. More than that. So already we've seen three regulations that I would argue are undergirded by mercy. Here, not only that, verse 9. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. Okay? So let's say he buys her as a slave, not for himself, but for his son. And ultimately, the son and she decide that they're going to be wed. All of a sudden, God's law says she has to be treated according to the custom of daughters. What does that mean? Well, here's what it means. It means at least two things. Number one, the master has to set her free. She's no longer a slave. Number two, the master must provide for her a dowry. A dowry is the bride price, right? Okay? Why? Because if she, the slave, marries his son, she's no longer a slave. She's a daughter. And so he must treat her as such. Okay? Verse 10. Again, not ideal, but realistic. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. Now, so this is basically a stipulation that says, if you take to yourself another woman because this slave maybe is displeasing to you or something like that, there's something going on there, right? So you bought this woman, but you really fell in love with this other woman, okay? Not ideal. God is regulating it, and he's regulating it in such a way to make sure that this slave who came into his house is not denied or is not treated as a second-class wife or concubine. Perhaps the master took this girl in when he was young because she was in a dire situation. He might have even done it as an act of mercy. And then later in life, there's another woman who comes along whom he really wants to marry. Again, not ideal, but regulated according to mercy. Mercy on behalf of the young woman who came in as the slave. And so food is clear, clothing is clear, conjugal rights, it's actually, in different translations, that will show up different ways. It's actually not an easy word to translate. Okay? The point here is that you cannot treat this woman whom you purchased as a second-class citizen in your home. She has all the rights of another woman who comes in. Okay? She can't be discarded. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. That is, she no longer has to be redeemed. She can just go if she has a place to go. Okay? So I realize, because we're going to move on to verse 12 after this, okay? I realize that maybe some of this is difficult for our ears, but we have to understand the context, right? And we have to see God's wisdom and righteousness and mercy in it. All right? Sometimes we see the text with 21st century eyes, and when we see that and we're jilted by it, we have to work hard. We've got to work hard. Okay? Verse 12. Now, God continues to expound on the second table. Remember, the second table was Commandments 5 through 10. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which you may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously towards his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. And he who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. And he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. And he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And if men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. And if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. And if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. And if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring, and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall also be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And if a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution, and he shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. And if one man's ox hurts another's, so it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. Okay. Let's roll through. Okay? Verse 12. Verse 12 is clear. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor, so that is apt to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. This is the difference between murder, premeditated murder, and manslaughter. Okay? This literally is at the root of our judicial system in these two categories. Okay? Sometimes men kill other men by accident. Right? So let's say two guys out chopping wood, right? One guy brings the axe back and the head flies off, hits the other guy in the head. Right? What happens in that case? Is it murder? No. It's not murder. Because murder assumes premeditation. Right? And so what's provided for here in verse 13 is what will later be known as cities of refuge. If you want to read more about cities of refuge, you can go to Numbers chapter 35. But in essence, God in Canaan provides six cities for this purpose. It's a place where someone who commits manslaughter, that is, kills another man by accident, can run to and run into that he might be protected from the vengeance of the family where the man died. Okay, Numbers 35. Because the penalty for manslaughter is not death. It's accident. Okay. However, verses 12 and 14 are about murder. Right? Premeditated murder. Verse 14. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. What does that mean? Well, the altar was historically a place in the tabernacle or the temple where people could run in to seek asylum. Churches also used to be places of asylum, where people who were in trouble, they would run into the church. And the church was a hallowed ground. And people, that was a safe place for them. They could not be killed in that space until it was assured that they got a fair trial. And the horns on the bronze altar acted in exactly the same way. If you want to see an example of this, you can look at 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 50. Okay? We're not going to go there now, just in the interest of time. But someone, right, a criminal, or at least a potential criminal, or an alleged criminal, could run in and grab onto the horns of the altar, and in that moment, then, they're protected by the priests from the vengeance of those who were seeking his life. And what God is saying is, if a man commits premeditated murder, then not even the horns of my altar can protect him. It's life for life. Okay? So God is not providing asylum for men who commit premeditated murder. Okay? Because God is upholding justice. Verse 15, he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Verse 17, and he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Right? This is violation of the fifth commandment. I skipped over verse 16. This is very important in the context of the discussion of slavery. And I made this case back in March of 2015. Exodus 21, verse 16. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. Was the African slave trade a heinous evil? Yes. Yes, to all of you listening on the internet. Why? Because the African slave trade was based wholly, wholly, on kidnapping. Whether it was the European people coming in or the Africans themselves, it was completely and wholly based on kidnapping, which is a clear violation. This is actually stated not only here in Exodus 21, verse 16, but it's also stated very clearly in 1 Timothy 1, verse 10. Man-stealers, there is no mercy for man-stealers. So, the African slave trade, leading to slavery in the United States of America and other parts of the Western world, it was a heinous evil and denounced by God. It is a categorical difference between that kind of slavery and the indentured servitude that we are talking about beginning in verse 2. It's a categorical difference. And that's something we have to understand. Verse 18. And if men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. Now, again, not ideal, but regulated. Would God have the Israelites beat on one another? Decidedly not. Not consistent with the second table. Okay? But God regulates it in such a way that the man who gets beaten, assuming he has to be compensated. Again, think, context, agrarian culture. Man gets up, and for consecutive days, he can't work in the field. That's loss of sustenance. So he must be compensated. Okay? So it's a regulation of the fallen world. Verse 20. And if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Now, I believe it's reasonable for us to assume that this is a justifiable discipline. Okay? This is not a ruthless beating. Right? But let's imagine, for example, that the servant steals from the master. Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? The regulations already stipulate, right, that he has to work 6 years and then go. Right? The master wants to keep him on. Right? So, I'm working under the assumption that verses 20 and 21 are justifiable discipline. Okay? If a man's... But you see, it's regulated. The master should not be disciplining his servants in such a way that they die. Do you see that? Now, how different is that, again, from what the Israelites experienced in Egypt? Verse 21. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property, says the New American Standard Version. Literally, you may have a note, literally what's being spoken of there is money. Okay? So, if the justifiable discipline is sufficiently harsh that the slave misses a day or two of work, the master has been punished. How? The servant didn't work. That's the punishment. What's the point? The point is God regulates this in such a way to say, look, if you want to discipline your slave for breaking the law, that option is open to you, but understand, first of all, if you do it in such a way, harshly, in anger, that you kill your servant, you are going to pay. You will be punished. If you do it in such a way that your servant misses a couple of days of work, understand, that's on you. There's no federal government, right, to provide additional wages, you know, for your hardship. If you're going to discipline your servant, do it in such a way that it is beneficial for you, and so, as a result, merciful to your servant. Not ideal, but regulated for mercy. Verse 22. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, let's be clear, okay? Miscarriage means something very specific to us. It means that the baby has died, right? It is most likely not what that's talking about, okay? It's actually an untimely birth, okay? Untimely birth. Again, I'm reading from the New American Standard, right? I think the working assumption here is that the baby comes early, survives, okay? Yet there is no further injury. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. So, because of the premature birth, the man may now go where? He may go to the judges and demand a payment. Again, the elders, the judges, the authorities, right? He can't just exact any punishment. He has to go and the judges have to hear the case. And this is important to understand because in verses 23, 24, and 25, we have the principle of lex talionis, right? We have the principle of justice, retaliatory justice. Why is this important? It's important for two reasons. Number one, it's the judges, it's an independent third party who decides what justice is. Lex talionis is not for interpersonal relationships, right? If you and I start rolling around because we have some difference, right? And you knock my tooth out. I am not righteously, in the moment, allowed to take a pair of pliers and rip your tooth out as a matter of justice. That's for the judges. Okay? That's issue number one. So lex talionis does not apply to interpersonal relationships. It is assumed that there is an authority that is instituting lex talionis. Does that make sense? Number two, here's why lex talionis is additionally important. Because in this culture, at this time, it was very often the case that if you and I were rolling around because we have some differences, right, and you knocked my tooth out, I would get so mad that I would one-up you. And I'd gouge your eye out. And assuming you were not in sufficient amount of pain that you couldn't function, you would turn around and now you would one-up me. Right? And you would rip my arm off. And now, oh, now I'm really mad. Right? And so you see how that works. Right? That's not justice. And so lex talionis is often criticized, right, as being without mercy. That's not the case. It is mercy undergirding justice. That is, no one should pay more than they owe, as regulated by the authorities. This is actually hemming in injustice, which was prevalent. And by the way, do you think it's not prevalent today? It is. It is. Okay? Violation of lex talionis. It happens all of the time. This is justice undergirded by mercy in direct contrast to the other cultures around them. Okay? For example, in Muslim countries today, you know what the payment is if you steal something? You get your hand cut off. That is not justice. That is not lex talionis. That's what this is about. More mercy for servants and slaves. Verse 26, and if a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. Again, not ideal, but regulating a sinful, fallen world whereby if the master is sufficiently harsh that even the slave's tooth comes out, in the context of justifiable discipline, automatically that slave is now free. Again, the ordinances of God hemming in the anger and the hatred of a master in this particular case. The master should be warned. Okay? If you're going to discipline your slave, be very, very careful. It might cost you. Okay? I assume this saved many a person's lives. Verse 28. I'm not going to read the whole thing again. But here we have this ox goring a man or a woman to death. The ox had to be killed. This is God's way of impressing upon the people the importance of life. Okay? If it's an accident, verse 28, the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If it's an accident. Or if it's the first time this ox did something like that. However, in verse 29, if this ox had a reputation for being out of control, or what also might be in view here in verse 29, is let's say that the owner of the ox, he was not responsible enough to keep his gate closed at night. Now, in either of those cases, if the ox had a history, or if he's irresponsible in keeping the gate closed or open at night, now who's responsible? The owner. The owner himself has jeopardized the lives of his neighbor. Remember, second table. Literally, in the case of verse 29, if the ox has a reputation or the owner is irresponsible, verse 29 is saying that when that ox kills your neighbor, you're in violation of you shall not murder. And the owner's life, in addition to the ox's life, is forfeit. It's forfeit. Verse 30 provides an out for that, provides an opportunity for a ransom of the owner. Again, mercy. Again, regulated by the judges and the authorities over the people. And why would this be the case? Well, let's be honest about it, right? Let's say you have a man and a woman and six kids, and the man is the guy who runs the farm. He could plead for his own life. His wife could plead for his life. And the judges have it within their authority to simply charge, right, a redemption price, so as to not put this other family, wife and children, and make them destitute. Okay? Mercy. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. That might be his own daughter, that might be someone else's daughter, right? It doesn't matter. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Okay? There's clearly a hierarchy here. Not the same category as son or daughter. Right? And we should note here that 30 shekels of silver is literally the slave's price. Right? And that should ring in our ears in the New Testament. That's the purchase price of Jesus our Lord. That was basically how Judas and the Pharisees saw Jesus, as nothing more than a lowly slave. And then in verses 33 through 36, we see the same type of thing. Again, the irresponsibility of a landowner who digs a pit and doesn't cover it. And what we see here is restitution and justice. What is God doing? God is, in many ways, providing a contrast between the way he is going to regulate the nation Israel in contrast to the way the Egyptians were dealing with their slaves and the way the Canaanites would deal with each other. Okay? From an apologetic standpoint, I understand that if people's ears are closed, they will not hear how these actually are merciful regulations of realities in a fallen world. I understand that. Trust me. Been in those conversations. Right? I just want you to see that God's ways are righteous and just in contrast to the surrounding cultures. And what undergirds so much of these regulations is God's mercy. It's God's mercy. Okay? Amen. Pastor.